Good evening. My name is Paul Holden-Graeber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library, now known as Live from the New York Public Library. Tonight, it is a pleasure to present to you a tribute to Rust Hills. A few announcements and many thank yous as well, so bear with me. That's what makes all this possible. Let me first start by expressing how this whole evening came into being. I was in Salt Lake City on my way to Sun Valley. I'm on the board of the Writers Conference in Sun Valley, and I got an email at the airport from Marilyn Johnson, who said to me that wrote to me that we must do a tribute to Rust Hills. I had no idea, I must admit to all of you, who Rust Hills was. She sent me the obituary that had just appeared in the pages, I believe, of the New York Times. And upon reading this obituary, I just felt deeply and dearly that this was something we had to do. We had to do it for a number of reasons, partly, I suppose, because a man described in this obituary seemed to be the last of a kind, a vanishing breed. And very, I don't know what is happening here, but it is, it's very, very animated, and I promise you I didn't plan this. And Marilyn Johnson also caught my eye in titling that email to me, Dead from the New York Public Library, because a few months earlier she had come up to me and said that she was a writer, which happens to me quite often in my line of business, and she then said that she had written, upon asking her, she said that she had written a book about obituaries. We ended up doing an event two or three weeks ago called Live from the New York Public Library Presents Dead from the New York Public Library with the obituary writer of The Economist. The Economist is quite interesting in that way because they only have 52 dead to review every year, whilst the New York Times, that was in the same room, has maybe 200 or 300, and maybe half of the undertakers of the New York Times were there that evening. But it felt to me that it was very important to do this tribute despite the fact that I didn't know who this man was. And she said that Richard Ford would be writing to me to express also his interest. I got a message a few minutes later from Richard Ford saying, "My name is Richard Ford and I am a writer." I was terribly surprised. And he thereafter expressed to me just how important he thought it would be for the New York Public Library to do an event about Rust Hills. And it is a great pleasure and a great honor to be doing this. We've done many tributes, most recently yesterday to Carol Shields. It was the 15th anniversary of the Stone Diaries. We've done events about on Nuala O'Faylon, Octavia Butler, the 20th anniversary of Primo Levi. And so it's a great pleasure to have you here today for this tribute to Rust Hills. A few thank yous. I need to thank our media sponsor, Metro. Every day we are in the pages of Metro. I would also like to thank our wine sponsor, Oriel. Oriel will be sponsoring in part a reception afterwards, and I encourage you all to stay. They are a wonderful purveyor and distributor of fine wines. Aristophanes inspires them to sponsor us. He said back then, "Quickly bring me a beaker of wine so that I may wet my mind and say something clever." So join their list and they will provide you with wine at your home. Please also consider joining the library. Become a friend in these times of economic crisis. The library needs you more than ever, and we certainly do. So just for $40 a year, you can become a friend of the library, which is quite a cheap date, if you ask me. As you know, and here I'm announcing very quickly our upcoming events. As you know, our tagline used to be that we wanted to make the lions roar. Now it has come. Now our tagline is Expect Wasabi. And in this season coming up, I would like to tell you what you still have to look forward to. In December, three events. Our season ends with the conductor and pianist Daniel Barenboim, who I will have the pleasure of interviewing. Just before that, we will have Omer Bartov, who will debate Avraham Burg. Burg's new book is The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. and Zadie Smith will deliver the Robert Silver's lecture this year. She just transmitted to me yesterday the title of her lecture, and I'd like to read it to you. Speaking in Tongues. What does it mean when we speak in different ways to different people? Is it a sign of duplicity or the mark of a complex sensibility? Zadie Smith takes a look at register and tone from the academy to the streets through black and white with examples such as Queen Elizabeth I, Shakespeare, Humbert, Obama. Thanks to Nancy Crampton for the photograph of Rust Hills, which is right there. Please stay, as I said, for our wine reception afterwards so we can continue the conversation thereafter. And first, to pay tribute to Rust Hills, we welcome Byron Dobble, who was a managing editor of Esquire magazine during the golden years of the magazine when Rust Hills was its fiction editor. Byron Dobble.
It was a very nice introduction, but it reminds me that one of the basic rules of Esquire was, if you're going to write about a bear, bring on the bear. From its first issue in 1933, Esquire established itself as a platform for the best fiction being written anywhere. Apart from its mildly risque pictures of young women in a state of undress and news of the latest men's fashions, its pages were filled with writers like Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Dreiser, Thomas Wolfe, Dos Passos, Saroyan, and Steinbeck. During the war, and you know which war I mean, Esquire became more conventional and much less entertaining, let alone literary. After the war, with the arrival of Playboy and its full frontal nudity, Esquire's circulation plummeted, and the magazine lost its way. Arnold Gingrich, the founding editor, returned from a self-imposed exile in Switzerland and decided the only hope for survival was to hand over his authority to a younger generation of editors with new ideas and enthusiasms and a more acute sense of humor. Now the magazine would focus on nonfiction by the likes of Tom Wolfe, Gay Talese, Tom Morgan, Gore Vidal, Dorothy Parker, Dwight MacDonald, Wilfred Sheed, Richard Revere, and Gary Wills. And at the same time would mount a renewed push towards literary fiction. Rust Hills, with his assistant Robert Brown, led the fiction charge, recruiting, in the years I worked with him, authors like Mailer, Nabokov, Heller, Evelyn Waugh, Malamud, Vonnegut, James Jones, Thomas Berger, Gina Berio, Isaac Singer, Heinrich Boll, Cheever, Styron, Updike, Bellow, Albee, Algren, Tennessee Williams, Thomas Pynchon, Evan Cannell, Frank Conroy, Terry Southern, and Bruce J. Friedman, as well as many others, some of whom are present this evening. Rust was responsible for what I consider the best single issue of Esquire. It was devoted to the American literary establishment and came out in July 1963. Early that year, Rust taped a large sheet of white cardboard on his office door, hand-printing on it various categories, such as the names of magazines, agents, publishing houses, and even colleges known for harboring good writers. Under the headings, Rust, with the help of everyone on the staff, listed the most important authors and influential literary forces on the scene. At the heart of what would eventually become a map of the literary world in 1963 was a section called and colored the Red Hot Center, where the most worthy movers and shakers were proclaimed, to the subsequent horror of those who didn't make it. There's no doubt in my mind that this issue, with its pictures and text built around Rust's chart, signaled the arrival of the second golden age of Esquire, 30 years after its founding, the golden age which is now the only one anyone remembers. Rust not only championed contemporary fiction, he loved the classics, and we would sometimes discuss our favorites over lunch. To my surprise, his favorite Dickens was Dombey and Son, which I had never read. The Dickens canon, then fashionable among academics like my teacher Lionel Trilling, consisted of Our Mutual Friend, Bleak House, and inexplicably to me, Little Dorrit. Following the publishing failure of Martin Chuzzlewit, Dickens was determined to write an irresistible bestseller with a cast of characters that included the most endearing dog since Odysseus trained Argos as a puppy. Dombey swept Europe, was translated into every major Western language, and was read by and influenced Tolstoy, Ibsen, and Proust. I now understand why Rust loved it so much. Dombey is a magnetic mixture of passion and action, emotion and intellect, drama and melodrama, and sublime sentimentality. In other words, the kind of great fiction Rust always hoped he would find at the Red Hot Center, a search to which Rusty, the epitome of sanity and good humor, without pretension or snobbery, devoted his life. Says that? Okay.
Hello, I'm Richard Ford. All of us here who knew Rust at one time or other have had this experience with him. It was one of the Rust Hills experiences. I would be with him in a car or talking to him on the telephone or sitting with him by a swimming pool enjoying a cocktail. And somehow or other, I would demonstrate some insignificant facility I had with the known world. For instance, I would instinctually know the location of a trustworthy liquor store in a town I didn't live in. Or I would succeed in getting an unidentified key to fit into a rusted lock. Or I would demonstrate an uncanny ability to change the dull blade on a saw just at the moment when we needed to trim a couple of pieces of wood to fit in the fireplace. And Rust would say, "Oh, Richard, you know how to do so many things. You're just amazing. I can't do anything like that myself. I so admire great facility in the world." I repeat to you that these were all intensely trivial abilities that any standard 12-year-old would have mastered. And I never for one instant thought Rust couldn't do any of them himself, though, of course, he may not have wanted to do them. There was always that side of Rust. "I like to go with" was a favorite saying of his, which translated into, "I like for you to do the wearisome things that need to be done, and I like for me to watch you do it and pretend to admire it." Whenever he said these things to me, these spontaneous and entirely unearned compliments, that I could so easily, for instance, tie my own shoes, or could master the intricacies of a slotted screwdriver, I always felt at first really good about myself, but then would begin to feel slightly jobbed and vaguely humiliated by them, as if Rust knew I was exactly the kind of person who'd be flattered by such things and could benefit from having my capabilities with the ordinary world reinforced in this way. Do not get me wrong. I always considered these unasked observations to be his way of declaring the complex Rust Hills friendship. You could say, and be right, that being Rust's friend continually involved sorting through intricately mixed messages. And you can say, and be right again, that Rust both held and exemplified an extremely complex view of human nature. And you could also say, with perhaps the greatest truth, that all of this represented in Rust a genuine and almost naive sense of wonder about the world which could be so perplexing and intricate and stubborn in its there-ness. In his way, I think he liked that, the wonder and the perplexity, and because he radiated liking it, he was himself, to me, lovable. But it was rare in my long friendship with Rust, more than 30 years duration, that I would put the telephone down from talking to him, or walk out the door at Esquire, or read a scrawled note for him, rare when I didn't feel myself to be suddenly possessed by this sensation of life's perplexing instability. It was as if when Rust spoke to you or liked you or addressed you in any significant way, he imparted into me this sensation of perplexity. Someone once said that the genius of Chet Baker was that he managed to express life's great question mark with so few notes. I always heard these vanishing notes when I was anywhere near Rust. It was the music that was always around him. His genius was that it played rather sweetly and found a purpose in him. Of course, all of this could make Rust a very difficult person to get a clear line on, or sometimes to get a straight story out of, which is what writers are always trying to do with their editors, whether they know it or not. And because it's my nature, this enigmatic quality of Rust's would often make me willing, make me even happy, to step over onto his bad side and to insist on something. Insisting was something Rust Hills definitely did not like. Or I would say something extremely lurid to him. If he didn't like insisting, he liked lurid things even less. I don't remember him ever even telling a dirty joke in my hearing. My strategy was that boorish behavior on my part would rub through Rust's decorous evasiveness with which he kept perplexity at bay and would possibly dislodge a solid answer out of him, and I promise you that it never worked. This unwillingness to stay within my or anybody else's crosshairs was evident in my most banal and also in my most significant interactions with Rust. For instance, when one went to lunch with Rust in New York, for us writers, as many of you know very well, when we go waltzing out of the office door with our editor and into the bright New York sunlight for a big sumptuous lunch, the editor always pays. It's the rule. But toward the end of lunch with Rust, and I'm thinking now about many lunches at the Carnegie Tavern, there'd be the grinding and inevitable moment when Rust would say, "Well, I don't know if I can charge Esquire all of this or not." "Oh, you're charging him," I say. Just don't even start that now, because I'm not paying anything and you're paying everything." And I knew Rust would already have begun brooding about his expense account and what a pittance Esquire was paying him, and wondering whether or not one more outsized lunch tab with one more promising but as yet unfulfilled novelist wouldn't just pave his way right out the door into the street. The fact that he was the best there was at his particular business, finding and editing fiction, and was indispensable to contemporary American literature, and the sole reason that Esquire could possibly consider itself a literary magazine at all, these considerations for that instance did not matter. The murky, uncertain world was suddenly up in his face again. And then there was the moment, now 25 years ago, when I gave Rust the best story I probably ever wrote, a story called Communist, which is in part about goose hunting. When he read it, he called me up immediately and said, "Richard, this is just a masterpiece. What an ending. I don't know how you do it. You're just amazing." My buttons were, of course, bursting. His praise meant everything to me. And then the next afternoon, he called me up and he said, "Well, this is a blood sport story, isn't it? And we just can't have that in the magazine. I'm sorry. Our readers will be screaming." And that was that. I was, of course, thrown into a fury. But fury also was not in Rust's editorial style book. He'd already generously published other stories of mine. He was not publishing this one. I had to understand this. That was simply the deal. But as hard as it was to coerce a straight story out of Rust, it was even more fruitless to stay mad at him. As I hope I've made clear, Rust presented a very unstationary target, and particularly a target for anger. And I tried to keep him in my sights, believe me. But he always, in his shrugging, demurring way, managed to make me feel that anger of any kind, but especially anger at him, was really a matter of intolerable extremeness and insensitivity. That he was, yes, a fallible man, but one the world ought never to get mad at. And moreover, that a man so civilized and capable of such wonders as I was should simply never stoop to such unseemly coarseness as anger. "Oh, Richard, I just can't talk to you that way about that," he'd say, and the subject was, whatever the subject was, forever buried. And so in proportion to the extent that he could make me infuriated, Russ, to me anyway, was ultimately irresistible. He was a man, after all, who seemed to seek ways to praise you and to praise other people. He was a man who deeply relished small and minor perfections. He loved to paint little watercolors. He had deep running passions he liked to share. And most importantly, Rust's hardwired awareness of life's large and permanent incongruities fed not into cynicism or into mean-spirited exclusivity, but into a sweet nature and into an embattled decorousness, his fabled fussiness, with which he tried to mend the wall against the crude, the murky, and the profane. And it also, this particular awareness, fed into something else too, which, thank goodness, is where we writers came into the Rust Hills picture. He loved literature's, as Byron said, he loved literature's beautiful formalities. To him, I think, literature offered a precious and sturdy means both to hold at bay, but also to countenance and even to like all that unruly and murky and unsimilatable stuff that's out there. It was in this spirit that he nurtured the work of untried young writers like me and like Beverly and lots more, and thrilled to find new readers for writers he already loved and wanted to champion like Jim Salter. In my life, and certainly in my generation, there was nobody like Rust Hills. You could say that he was a man of another time, but that wouldn't tell enough. He was a seminal editor. He did his version of God's work and loved doing it. He saw editing as a vocation, not merely as a profession. And in the process, he was quirky and admirable and fussy and comical and infuriating. And as I said, he was lovable. But what will keep him alive for me forever is that the flickers of good he saw in himself and in that complex world, particularly the delight he found in the beautiful formalized world inside of stories, the things he tried hard to find elsewhere and in others. And when he thought he saw it in others, he made it his business to see that it grew and that it flourished. This is very rare in human beings. In human terms, if you were privileged to know Rust Hills in this way, as a few of us here tonight were, you had that great, uncommon opportunity to see not just your cherished editor and your friend, but in fact, a man complete. Thanks.
I'm reminded of Jerry Lee Lewis. My name is Terry McDonald. I worked with Rust at Esquire from 1990 to 1993. In thinking about this and Rust and what I might say, it occurred to me that I should ask around a little bit. So I called Jim Harrison, and we discussed Rust for a while. And Jim said that instead of me talking about what he thought, he wanted to write something, and he did. And I'm going to read that to you to begin with here. I'm sure you all know that the publication in Esquire of Legends of the Fall sort of changed things in American popular fiction for a moment there, and it was a very important thing for the magazine and, of course, for Jim. Jim says, "I knew Rust Hills since the 70s. Like all true lovers of literature, he was a remarkably cranky man. I was thrilled when he got my Legends in the Fall into Esquire. I visited he and Joy on their lagoon in Sarasota, and it took us 4 liquid-filled days to edit 7 pages out of Revenge. We always had a fine argumentative time together." Jim Harrison. Now, I see a theme emerging here. And to continue that, I think I need you to understand what it was like for me right before I went to work at Esquire. I went there, I guess it was the fall, late fall of 89, and that summer they had run in the magazine this. This, as a spread like that, there were some words here, and it said, "Oh my God," or some headline like that. And this was the heir to the Chart and Red Hot Center that Byron had mentioned, Russ had instigated some time earlier, which I was aware of. Now, in my relatively undistinguished career, I'd liked fiction, and I liked fiction writers, and I always wanted to bring them in wherever I was working, hopefully get them to write some nonfiction, et cetera, et cetera. But this thing, if you see what it is, these are all little stickies, and each one of them has the name of a writer on it. And this, what they called Tree of Fame, is in fact a pyramid of shame, or, you know, of doom, something. This was very, very dangerous stuff. It was, I mean, you wouldn't want, I mean, what writer could in his heart be proud to be on here? And yet, as they wrote in the caption copy, what would it be like to be left off? It was in that spirit that they published it and said that, in fact, this is like showing Dracula to the light. This will kill this ambition. I was troubled by this. I had, walking into Esquire, I had noticed that although I knew certain people around and about and had done some work, you know, Jim was here, Cormac was, you know, there were people, but most of my friends were down here. I'm going to just put this over here so that you can all come up and enjoy it later. But the thing about it was that walking into Esquire, you know, I had big plans and big hopes, and I remember that with this in the back of my mind. The first day, I think David Hershey said, "Russ is going to call you." I said, "Well, good. What's his number? I'll call him." He said, "Oh, don't call him." So I didn't know quite what that meant. I learned later. Maybe I can. Oh, before I go on, I believe that Will Blythe should explain this when it is his turn to speak. Because as I walked around the halls of Esquire and waited for Russ to come, it was very clear to me, you know, that this was somewhere in those offices. And I was not sneaky enough to actually look after hours to see if I could find it. But I had it on good authority that it sat propped up in a cubicle as far as you could be from my office, which was where Russ sat. But I had not met him yet. But on the phone that day, that first day, he said to me, he said, "You know, we have to talk." And I said, "Well, you're right." He said, "But I have some things that we need to talk about." I said, "Well, what might that be?" He said, "Well, I have a certain, at Esquire, I enjoy a certain, I have a kind of an autonomy here when it comes to fiction. And I need to talk to you about my autonomy." And, you know, nothing I like better than a good chat about autonomy. So I said, "Well, you know, come on down." But he couldn't because he was in Florida. So he was going. It was going to be. And the reason that he was in Florida was that his expense account had been cut back so drastically by the dastardly Lee Eisenberg that, in fact, he could only afford a certain number of trips a year. So we were going to have to put off this very, very important conversation, unless, of course, there was some way that a plane ticket could be found and he could, in fact, come in sooner. And I thought, nah. but he came. He came quickly enough anyway. And he came. We were gonna meet in my office and then go to lunch. And I prepared for this because I wanted to disarm him. I had been listening to stories within the office about much of the things that Richard underlined so brilliantly. And when he walked in, I said, "You know, that fussy man material is the best stuff I've ever read." And it just brushed right by him. It was almost as if I had not said a word. He said, well, you know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about the fiction at Esquire and what you might be thinking that you want to do with the fiction at Esquire. And I must tell you that I have no idea what you're thinking, but I am almost certain that I disagree with it. And, you know, and I said, well, you know, let's talk about collaboration. He said, and you know, there's another thing. I have to buy lunch for every writer that ever wants, you know, and on. It turned out okay, though. We had some laughs, and we, you know, some things happened that we both enjoyed. We published some writing that we were all proud of, and I cherish all that. But we'll leave you with this one last little set piece. Right after I arrived, in the late winter of that year, in very early, I guess it was 90, when the National Magazine Awards came out, Esquire got a whole bunch of nominations, as always, there was only one that I had even the slightest possibility of attaching myself to in terms of anything that I was responsible for. But of course, there was one for fiction, and the custom there is, or what you have to do is whoever is the sitting editor-in-chief accepts the award for the magazine. So we go to the Waldorf, and we're in that profoundly stupid dining room, and we have a good table by the front, because I think Lee had gotten 4 or 5 nominations. That's how that works that year. We're up there pretty close, you can see, and of course, Esquire wins for fiction. This is not maybe in the best interest of my career, but I was going to be big about this anyway. So I came up just like this. I looked out to say something about the importance of fiction in America, and I looked at the table where we were sitting, and there was Rust waving at me. He was. And I said, but never mind. If there's anyone who deserves this award, it's Rust Hills. Because Rust has been the fiction editor since I maybe said 1936, I don't know, something. But I mentioned the Red Hot Center, and called Rust to the stage. Everyone seemed to know who he was in the Waldorf, and thundering applause. And I thought, now we'll see. He's going to let them know, et cetera. He came up, and he just looked at me. He looked out at them, and he said, "Thank you," and off we went. Except we returned to our table, and as is the custom at those luncheons or dinners or whatever they are now, you would take the Calder Ellie, the elephant, the stable, and put it in the center of the table, hoping for more, which I did. And Rust leaned forward, grabbed it, and pulled it toward him, and leaned over to me and said, "I really can't keep this, can't I, Terry?" And that's kind of why I'm here tonight. I've thought about that a lot, because what I said was, of course you can't keep it. The magazine won that. It's collaborative. There is no autonomy. And more importantly, the Hearst Company and all of the reasons that we are allowed to go forward with this, like to put those things in the lobby. We have a lot of them. That's where they live. Editors don't get to keep them. And this made him sad. And when I think back about, you know, the mistakes you've made, the regrets that you have, it can be a bumpy road. But the one that I have, but that still makes me smile, because it was just sort of the truest thing I can think about Rust, is that no one that I ever worked with actually cared more about writers and writing and the writing life and how that all worked together and living and life and writing and all of that in some swirl that once in a while would wind up with something like that. And I just wish that I had just said, shit, yes, handed it to him and told him to go and put it in his Florida room in Sarasota or wherever it was. But thanks very much.
Hello, I'm Beverly Lowry. Back in the 60s, when I thought I wanted to be an actress, there was a time when I was waiting for a bus. I was living in New York and going to HB Studio. And I should be embarrassed to tell this story, but if writers don't write about what embarrasses them, they're probably writing stuff that's too safe anyway. I looked across the street at a huge apartment building where I thought the wealthy and important lived. And I fantasized someone looking out of a window and seeing me down there on the avenue waiting for the bus and saying, get me that girl. And I told this story to a group of would-be actors in class, and they laughed nervously because everybody in that room had the same illusion, the fantasy of somebody wanted them to be their performer. And I've thought about this since then, and it's the desire to move, to make the leap from obscurity at least to the realm of possibility. And it seems so difficult and impossible when you're in that little bubble of obscurity. In the 70s, I came to my senses and realized that what I was a writer, not an actress. Not too many other people believed that because I was in my home raising my sons, living in Houston, Texas, writing in my house and writing stories and sending them out and getting them back and sending them out and getting them back. I also did a lot of reading, and among the publications I read was, of course, Esquire. Russ Teals at that time was writing a column for Esquire. And there was a column he wrote about short stories and how short stories made for a kind of community of readers in perhaps a way that the reading of novels did not. And he cited a couple of writers. One was Donald Barthelme, another was Gilbert Rogan. And then he went even to a more specific place and named particular stories he admired of those. I, too, liked those writers a great deal. And not only that, those were my favorite stories of these writers. He got all the way down to the last paragraph when he said, this makes for a brotherhood of men, people who have read these stories. Women, of course, he said, have their own way of bonding and making a community. So now, obviously, Esquire is the magazine for men, but I wrote him a jokey little note saying, well, I was with you the whole way, and you cut me out in your last paragraph, and sent it off, went on about my life, raising my kids, reading and writing, until about 2 weeks later, I guess, I got a little blue envelope, just one of these that like you write thank you notes on, with Russ Teals from Florida on it. I opened it up, and he said, dear Beverly, I'm pretty hungover, but I do want to respond to your letter. This letter has disappeared, as far as I know, mine, his, so you will never see it, I think. And he said, he apologized and said I was probably right. Well, I showed it to people, and they all had the same response, which was, send him a story. And I said, no, this is not that kind of thing. It would be crass to send a story now. But after getting a few more rejection slips, I decided that maybe I could be that crass. And I sent him a couple of stories and said, I didn't mean to do this. I didn't write you that note in order to send you some stories. But here's what I'm working on. I'm also working on a novel. And Rust wrote back and said he quite liked the stories. And he was handing them on to a woman who had been working for Esquire named Pat Rotter. And she was quite taken with the stories, and particularly in the novel I was writing. Within a couple of years, my novel had been sold and was published. And I felt like I had finally had that get me that girl moment, that out of all the mail, this famous man, and to me, it was like the great man that somebody down in Texas was writing, had actually read my letter, responded to the stories, and written me, and done an elemental thing, which was not just to say I like these stories, but to actually move them along into a world in which I might reach the realm of possibilities, at least. And so I didn't work with Rust as an editor. I don't know him as an editor. I know his work, and I know the writers he worked with. But for me, I have to say, he used to say, I'm the one who discovered Beverly Lowry. And he did. He did. You know, people say that, and it's often not true, but he really did. So he didn't edit my work, but he changed my life.
I'm Will Blythe, and I was honored to be a colleague of Rust for a long time. Fiction, like painting, like the Democratic Party, and like many other good things, has died a lot over the last several decades, only to keep coming back to life. But like the rest of us, great fiction editors get to die only once. I met perhaps the greatest of them all in 1987, when I signed on to be Rust Hill's editorial assistant at Esquire magazine. As he ushered me in to finalize the deal with Lee Eisenberg, the magazine's editor-in-chief, Rust, not wanting to upset fiction's precarious place on the Esquire apple cart, told me, "Whatever you do, don't ask for too much money." We finalized the terms with Rust peering anxiously through the glass partition that separated Lee's office from the rest of the magazine as I negotiated my way down to $14,500 a year, which I realize is big money these days, but back in 1987, it didn't go very far. Rust, however, told me that I had done wonderfully in my first negotiation, and for an hour or two, I actually believed him. Fortunately, money was never the point. With Rust, the point was to publish great writing and to have fun doing so. Show the flag, he told me that first summer, as if sending me into battle, though in fact dispatching me downtown to a book party for Richard Ford's illustrious Rock Springs. His enthusiasm for even the most routine publishing party often resulted in my having had a better time as we talked about it on the phone than I had at the actual event. His ardor mystified me until Rust, down in Key West, absent from the publishing world in New York, explained one of his rules for social life. The best cocktail parties, he told me, are the ones to which you're not invited. Until I met Rust, I had also thought that the three martini lunch was a myth from a legendary time in New York publishing that had not survived the introduction of bottled water. With Rust, maybe it was actually two Manhattans, maybe it was three Negronis, maybe it was a plate of Franks and beans at the Cosmic Coffee Shop. If I remembered better, they wouldn't have been such glorious lunches. Life, Rust once wrote, is a three-legged stool supported by booze, coffee, and smokes. Kick any leg of the stool and the whole old corpus comes crashing down to the kitchen floor. Use it all up, his example seemed to say. Life is not meant to be hoarded. This did not mean, as it turned out, that he was not a careful and considerate man. He was, in fact, a very careful man, or, as he called himself, a fussy man. He believed there was a right way to do things: fold a map, eat an ice cream cone, give a dinner party. And he even once described to me with great pride how he had hung a tennis ball from the ceiling of his garage so that he would know when he had driven exactly the right distance into the garage by the tennis ball gently tapping against his windshield. Such precision was not my forte, however, and I was not therefore always an ideal colleague. Rust used to blanch whenever he dared to look into my office with its vast unnamed mountain ranges of unopened manuscripts and unanswered correspondence. He tried in vain to excite me about the possibilities of order. Cleaning up as you go along is half the fun, he said. Many such maxims are collected in his wonderfully sly and deeply humane book, worthy of his hero Montaigne, called How to Do Things Right, The Revelations of a Fussy Man. It has a kind of sophisticated naivete, I know of no other way to put it, that reminds me of Rust the Man. It's really just so Rustian, charming, cantankerous, with deep notes of melancholy. The most ethical form of behavior, Rust suggests, in How to Do Things Right, is to be interested and interesting. This naturally requires great attentiveness, which leads to another of his slogans. Carefulness is love. Love is carefulness. Well, for all of his carefulness, Russ did have a mutinous sense of fun, which I was only too happy to aid and abet. This once meant our doing a survey of the sex lives of American writers, many of whom did not appreciate our sincere interest in how many times a week they did it. Unsurprisingly, there were some who did appreciate our interest and wrote us back more than we wanted to know. We also built that shameful pyramid made of yellow Post-its, ranking the writers in America from 1 to 100. And after our lunchtime Manhattans, we occupied many a dreamy afternoon moving writers from one position to another. This went on for years, actually. One day, a writer whose name shall go unmentioned, but I promise you, it's no one in this room, at least I don't think so, stopped by unexpectedly. While Rust effusively welcomed him, or her, I was dispatched to vault the writer high up the pyramid, just in time for said writer to be escorted by Rust into the cubicle where the pyramid was hidden. The writer still felt his ranking to be a little low, but it could have been much worse. Rust's care, his fussiness, was most evident to me in his work as an editor. His celebrated capacity for tattering together with his scissors and tape a self-sufficient excerpt, sometimes greater than its antecedent, but in any case certainly shorter, found perhaps its most vivid expression in his daydream of cutting Proust and making an abridged version of A Remembrance of Things Past. As he imagined it, a couple of Random House bigwigs fall all over themselves at the idea. They promise Rust a fat advance. They warn him that, quote, Proust scholars will be envious of you, Rust, of course, but they'll realize that a trained fiction editor is what's needed here, and that as a long-winded writer yourself, you'll just naturally know how to cut the daylights out of Proust. I think there are a lot of writers out there who know how Proust would have felt. The truth is, they would have been in good hands. A fussy man cares enough about things to get his feelings hurt. And Rust took it personally when a writer did not offer his firstborn to Esquire. And come to think of it, his second, third, fourth, and fifthborns too, and so on down the family line. He told me once that he understood that a writer might eventually want to publish in The New Yorker. They all do, he said, with a weary sigh. But in no instance that I can recall did he want this to happen on his watch. His sympathy for the oh-so-predictable aspirations of writers sooner or later collided with the intensity of his love for their particular writing. There were stories that he just had to have, and The New Yorker could get in line. I remember, for instance, when James Salter's masterpiece of a short story, American Express, hung in the balance. For a few days, it looked like The New Yorker had it. Rust went into full battle mode. I don't know whether Jim knows the full extent of the feverish campaign to wrest his story away from The New Yorker, a campaign worthy of Douglas MacArthur's return to the Philippines. The phone lines glowed red on the other side of the cubicle wall. Rust called the agent. He called the agent's assistant. He called Salter. He even called some woebegone and outmatched functionary from The New Yorker, and then he started calling everyone all over again. To hear him on the phone for days, charming and wheedling and blustering and glowering, was to witness a master at work. What I took away from this was not his successful machinations, he got the story, by the way, but that Rust loved a piece of fiction that much, that he cared enough to risk making enemies and offending friends and looking like a fool desperately in love with fiction, which he was. And speaking of fools, there's no greater fool than a young man fresh in the New York publishing world, and I confess that in my early days at Esquire, I suspected that Rust's fervor for reading was really an excuse for keeping his cushy job arrangement, which allowed him to edit from afar, occasionally blazing into the city with his battered promotional Esquire bag and his dog-eared copy of Montaigne, like one of those periodic comets that he featured in his maps of the literary universe. But no, I was mistaken. Where many editors read manuscripts to dismiss them, Russ read to fall in love. Over the 10 years we were together at Esquire, Russ and I would often talk on the phone, mainly because he tended to be in Key West and I tended to be in New York. Inevitably, there came a point in the conversation when he begged me to send him something to read, short stories, novels, anacrostics from the back of Harper's, and he was very good at those. Anything. Just make a big stack and slip it in an envelope for me, he'd say. Send me a bunch of things. Oh, please, Will, do it now before you forget. After we both left Esquire, he and I continued to talk once in a blue moon. After a little gossip, which he was always eager to hear, we talked about what we always talked about, books and writers. The last time we spoke, Russ told me that he was rereading 19th century English novelists, George Eliot, Charles Dickens, and he was writing chapters about the happiness of reading such things and the happiness of reading in general. And as we reached the end of the conversation and it was time to say goodbye, he said the same thing he probably said to me at the end of our first phone conversation 20 or so years before. Send me something to read. I wish I could have sent him this, not because it's any great shakes as writing. In fact, I fear the devastating half-word of praise Russ might have slipped in like a scalpel. A phrase like, gee, Will, that's sort of nifty. I just wish he could have known, without being embarrassed, the great esteem in which I and so many others held him for his willingness to put himself at the service of other people's visions and for making it all so much fun along the way. Thank you.
I'm Lee Eisenberg, and I don't know whether I'm up here to pay tribute to Rust or to reclaim my reputation as a cheap-ass boss. Obviously, this is a split crowd. Some of us in the room knew Rust all too well, and some of you did not. And in fact, many of you may have been introduced to Rust for the first time by that obituary that in the Times that Paul referred to, was written by Bruce Weber, who also, before he went to the Times, used to work for Rust. And a number of things that Bruce said in that obituary I think are worth putting into context, and I'm going to try to do that in just a second. But before I do, I want to go back to that photograph. That photograph that's on the easel and that's also in your program was the photograph that ran in the Times next to Rust's obit. And just to fill you in on some of the details, that's Rust, obviously, sitting at the desk in his home office in Stonington, Connecticut. I believe the picture was taken around 1973, and you have a very, very vivid depiction of Rust smiling his best golden retriever-like smile, which he did quite often. And I think it was taken around the time that one of the books in his trilogy, How to Retire at 41, came out. As I know some of you did, I had the pleasure of spending quite a few delightful evenings in Stonington with Rust and Joy. It's a wonderful house, an old farmhouse with low ceiling rooms and sloping wood floors and windows that looked out on a lovely cove. And there was a boathouse by the cove where Rust kept a Boston Whaler. Which Joy and Rust and friends would occasionally use to take picnic trips over to, I think, Fisher's Island, if I remember my Block Island Sound geography properly. And by the way, the rumor that Rust Hills was born with a canvas tote attached to his hand is, for all intents and purposes, true. Now, in his own charming book, which have been alluded to, and I'm not going to go back to those, Rust memorably chronicled Cove Side and gave us, as Will said, many, many wise and enduring lessons on the orderly life, well-led, the tennis ball, how to eat an ice cream cone without the ice cream dripping on your shirt, and so on. But there was much, much more. Rust really lived that life. At Cove Side, there was a handwritten sheet taped inside a kitchen cabinet, spelling out, I don't know if it was a month's or a year's or 5 years worth of dinners, no two dinners ever repeating. This is a man who did crave order. And there was another note that I came across, I think he may have included it in a book, that said, one of life's greatest pleasures is putting something back where it belongs. Now, back to that photo for a minute. It looks a little messy, right? The stuff in the room, the stuff on the desk, it all looks a little messy, but it's not messy at all. It's very meticulously scattered. Everything that is Rust is essentially in that picture. A cigarette in his left hand, a highball glass, empty or nearly empty, I can't really tell from the photograph, in his right hand. There's a coffee mug filled with pencils. There's an ashtray with some butts in it. There's a black rotary telephone in the back of the picture. And, of course, there are manuscript pages scattered all over the desk. And what really struck me, dead smack in the center of this chaos, you see a classic object of order, an old-fashioned cardboard clipboard holding, obviously, some manuscript pages, perhaps some pages that Rust himself was writing or someone else's that he was committed to improving. Now, for those of you who did not know Rust and for those of you who never saw Rust at work, here is the essential thing you really need to understand about him. He was a man at one with basic office supplies. Simple, low-tech, actually no-tech, office supplies. Some of them have been referred to earlier, that clipboard, number two pencils, scotch tape, paper clips, stapler, scissors. I have never known an editor whose methods made the computer age seem so entirely unnecessary. And Rust, as you've heard, could work magic with those simple tools, literally cutting and pasting or taping paragraphs or snippets of paragraphs as he moved them from one part of a manuscript that hadn't found itself to another part of the manuscript. Now, throughout the 70s and 80s, Rust and I each came and went back and forth to Esquire several times, so I really can't calculate how many years we worked together. But our closest collaboration, and it was nonstop for many, many months, came when we were asked to form something of a two-man tag team match assigned to edit, to commission and edit, Esquire's 50th anniversary issue. And with all due respect to Byron, mentioning the Red Hot Center as the best single issue Esquire ever published. Esquire is nothing but a fractious institution. I'm telling you, this was the best single issue of Esquire. That might have been the best spread, Byron, but this was the best issue. And it was 1983, 50th anniversary issue. It was an enormous issue. If not the best, it was the biggest. You'll give me that. An issue that honored 50 men and women who, according to us, had dramatically shaped the culture over the course of Esquire's existence to date. Now, our job, and it was a terrific job, was to go out and persuade 50 of America's most revered journalists and literary figures, each to write a profile of a man or woman who had shaped the previous half century. And everyone we asked, Ford, Salter, both here tonight, Capote, Vidal, Mailer, Bello, you've heard the litany of great writers, Tom Wolfe, Peter Drucker, they all agreed. The only one who did not agree, the only one we really wanted who did not agree, was Philip Roth, who turned us down rather nastily, which really pissed Rust off, and I have very, very little doubt, wherever Rust is at this moment, and especially if there's a scotch and soda where he is at this moment, he is still crabby as hell at Roth's curt refusal to participate in this project. And as I said, it was an immense project. Putting it together, pulling it together, called for hundreds and hundreds of letters back and forth, contracts coming and going, phone messages to and from agents, notes and memos from us to the rest of the staff, and needless to say, all of that amounted to this massive mountain of documentation. Now, to keep everything straight, we knew, Rust and I knew, that we needed a system, a simple but effective system, and, of course, a job made for Rust Hills. And in about 10 minutes, no more than that, using nearly a full quiver of all these low-tech, no-tech office supplies, he created what he called the Nerve Center. Now, you've seen various charts up here. Being a competitive person, I'm going to go one step further. But before I actually show you the original, not some laminated Rust Hills thing, but the original Nerve Center, I simply want to say this is Rust's fussiness at his absolute quintessential best. So impressive that for the next 25 years, for the past 25 years, I have been carting around several large boxes full of correspondence from that issue, carrying it from house to house, state to state, never opening it, never looking into any of it. And a couple of years ago, as Linda and I were packing to move yet again, I told her that once and for all this stuff was gone. All this stuff was going out to the dumpster. And she had the good sense to say, no, don't do that. Why don't you give it all to a library for preservation purposes? And I did, in this case, the library at the University of Pennsylvania. So it pleases me no end to let everybody know that Rust's contributions to that wonderful issue, the Nerve Center itself, with all the memos, the notes, the phone messages, the odd scraps, the jottings, everything, are now preserved, and Rust will love hearing this, in plastic sleeves. The plastic sleeves being in marked folders, and the marked folders snug in acid-free cardboard boxes in the rare book room at the Van Pelt Library at the University of Pennsylvania. Everything, by the way, precisely where it belongs. So now, Rust may be still dyspeptic over Ross turning us down, but I'm quite sure he's delighted that the archive is preserved for future generations of scholars, anybody whose dissertation might inquire into the deeper reaches of 20th century magazine writing, or even, who knows, the semiotics of fuss. Now, a few weeks ago, knowing that I was going to be here tonight, I went to Philadelphia on my own dime. And browsed through those boxes in search of the crown jewel, the keystone, the lost ark of all of this material. And I found it. Here it is. This is the Nerve Center of the Nerve Center. And I'm very pleased to say that thanks to the library, every one of you tonight, as you leave, will get a Xerox copy of the Nerve Center. Now, let me just quickly, so when you take it home tonight, you know exactly what happened. What you're looking at are two lined sheets of paper that Rust scotch taped down the back to make one. And then with a number two pencil and a ruler, drew, as you will see later, an extraordinarily precise grid that had 11 columns running down each page, resulting in over, as we would say today in the age of Excel spreadsheets, 500 cells to be filled in as the issue took form. The columns were author, subject, length, dollars, and then my favorite one, friendly letter. And when we sent out a friendly letter, we ticked the box. Contract out, contract in, due date, manuscript in, check issued, estimated magazine pages. Oh, and there's one other great, great thing, perhaps the best thing. Maybe you can see it from there, but you can see it later. Right over here, in the extreme left-hand column, you will see a cigarette burn. One day, working on the Nerve Center, Rust dropped an ash on the Nerve Center. That nearly sent the entire nerve center up in smoke. But he flung himself across one of those gray metal Army-issue desks and managed to save the nerve center. It was right out of Indiana Jones. In the nick of time, but you will still see right here between Richard Reeves writing on George Gallup and Ken Kesey writing on Jack Kerouac, the remnant of Rust's cigarette. Otherwise, everybody else, you guys, you big guys there, Salter, Ford, Capote, Vidal, Mailer, Bello, Wolf, Drucker, you all survived, but not Philip Roth. And you are all meticulously accounted for, and you will live in the nerve center forever. Now, somebody talked about Rust's commitment to writers. Protecting writers' interests really, really was Rust's most important priority, which brings me back to some of the words that Bruce Weber used in his obituary in the New York Times. Bruce, who really loved Rust, used adjectives that, if you knew Rust, were accurate and they were affectionate. But if you didn't really know Rust, you might not know how to take some of these adjectives, and they are adjectives that you don't often come across in an obituary. Passive-aggressive. Curmudgeonly. Cranky. Now, the fact is, as you've heard, Rust really was all of those things, but it's very, very, for those of you who didn't know him, to understand that he was those things in a uniquely Rustian way. Unfailingly courteous, as you've heard, charming, even gentle. I hesitate to use the word Gentile, but he was that too. So, as I was rummaging through the archives at the Penn Library, I began to look for documented evidence that those, you know, so sort of somewhat ambivalent or ambiguous adjectives, I look for evidence that I could actually bring to you tonight. And I was pretty successful. Take passive-aggressive. In the archive, I found a handwritten note that Rust had sent to John Kenneth Galbraith, who had submitted a draft on Eleanor Roosevelt. And Rust thanked Galbraith profusely for having been so prompt in sending us the manuscript. But what Rust meant by prompt was disappointingly slapdash. But Rust being Rust would never in a million years ever say those words to someone as eminent as Galbraith. So this is what Rust, in fact, did say. It's all there in the nerve center. Quote, "We are absolutely delighted with your piece. The points you make about Roosevelt's threefold achievements are all excellent, and it is a wonderful tribute to an extraordinary woman." Rust then said that he had but one or two modest, always modest, suggestions for how Galbraith might go about fixing the piece. And needless to say, those one or two modest suggestions turned into four exquisitely detailed single-spaced pages. Ken, what did Eleanor's apartment look like? Ken, you speak of her effect on FDR's policies. Could you explain? Ken, you tell us of Eleanor's role in shaping the relationship between women and political power. Might you compare and contrast with first ladies ever since? Passive aggressiveness. Yes, but passive aggressiveness always slip covered in velvet, or maybe to be more precise, in well-worn corduroy, a Rust trademark, as you can see from the photo over here. Bruce said that Rust could be cranky. Plenty of evidence of this in the boxes there at the University of Pennsylvania. For instance, somewhere along the way, Harry Stein, who was a columnist in Esquire, had seen fit to flatter me, hard as that may be to believe, shamelessly in a note, going on and on and on about how, quote, great my editing had been on Harry's piece about Benjamin Spock. Very shortly thereafter, Rust got a brief note from William F. Buckley, Jr., who was writing about Henry Luce. I'll read it to you in full. It will not take long. Dear Rust, that was awfully nice of you to speak so kindly to Francis Bronson, Bill Buckley's secretary, about my piece. These gestures are hugely appreciated. With cordial regards, Bill. That was it. Now, coming on the heels of Harry Stein's shameless flattery of me, that Buckley note really pissed Rust off. So he struck back. He's cranky. He's passive-aggressive. And he struck back in a classic Rustian way. He sharpened one of those number two pencils, and he scrawled a note in the margin. And given the brevity of that note, there was a lot of margin. And what Rust said was this. I quote, "Lee, is it better to be a great editor, parenthesis, Stein's view of you, or just a, quote, nice guy, parenthesis, Buckley's view of me, Rust?" Rust was, bottom line, he was both of those things. He was a great editor, as you've heard. He was a nice guy, albeit cranky, curmudgeonly, passive-aggressive. And one more thing, which is another oddball word that occurred in the obituary, and you never see this word in obituary. Bruce Weber said that Rust was persnickety. You don't hear that word very much in any context. But it's a great word for Rust. It's, you know, we all know what it means. It means fussy about small details. It means fastidious. It means requiring great precision. But as was acknowledged earlier, it's a word from another time. It's a word from another moment in our culture. And that time was a better time for magazines and for those who sent stories into magazines. But thanks to a handful of persnickety types, Esquire and many other magazines back in the 60s through the 80s made room for those stories. Rust was the high priest of persnickety. He was a delightful companion, a deft and disarming writer himself, a truly committed editor, and yes, as Bill Buckley said, just a nice guy as well. Rust was, to try to pull all of that together, a simple, self-made system unto himself, a system that really worked, held together not by staples, not by tape, not by glue, but by intelligence and wit and charm, all in their proper place. Thank you. And the nerve centers are on the table as you leave. Thank you.
I'm Catlin Love Hills. I'm Rust's daughter, and I'm actually reading for Christopher Buckley, who could not be here today, and I hope I do his words justice. Christopher Buckley, remembering Rust. In my reluctant absence, I've asked my dear friend Catlin Hills to read the small tribute to my great buddy Rust Hills. I met Rust at Esquire in 1978, which means that our friendship goes back, gosh, 30 years. For me, it was love at first sight. The great, indeed, legendary editor, Rust Hills. Imagine working right down the hall. Wow, sometimes you just get lucky. I sure did. We became friends quickly. I was a willing and eager disciple, and he, as many of you know so well, a happy mentor. He drew me into his unique universe. Its red-hot centers, to use a term he made famous in the pages of Esquire, were his beloved Lammies, Joy and Catlin. The geographical epicenters were the Cove and Stonington, pronounced in his Yankee way, Stunnington, and the exotic Bohemian Jungle House at 8128 Midnight Pass Road in Siesta Key. How I miss them both. Over our three decades of friendship, the telephone would reliably ring every 3 weeks or so. The voice at the other end, increasingly gravelly in later years, would announce, "It's just old Rust calling." I would exclaim, "Rusto!" And we would have our chin wags, his coinage, naturally. about whatever Trollope or Dickens novel he had just reread, how he loved those Victorians, or it might be to tell me what literary award Joy had just won, or what fun new job saving the world Catlin had just landed, who had just arrived in Key West for the winter, and when was I coming down for a visit. Those visits to Key West were like sleepovers at a friend's house when you were a kid. Nothing was more fun or exciting. We were boys again. Russ would turn every quotidian moment, every task, chore, or errand into a ritual or even sacrament. Going to Fausto's grocery store to get a half a pint of ice cream or steak, sorry, Joy, for dinner would take on all the aura of planning a military invasion. There would, of course, be the all-important drawing up of the list. The getting into the vehicle. The driving of the vehicle. The getting of gas for the vehicle. For Resto, life was an endless to-do list. He had the knack of making the ordinary exciting. God, he was fun. One day, flummoxed by the fact that la-di-da, our favorite source in Key West for Bloody Marys and Eggs Benedicts, was inexplicably closed, we ended up, for reasons I cannot quite explain, driving 50 miles up to Route A1A, ending up in Marathon Key at a roadside barbecue joint called Porky's. It became our absolutely favorite place on earth. That's spelled with capital letters in Russ's signature style. On every subsequent visit to Key West, we absolutely had to include a 100-mile round-trip lunch outing to Porky's. It was traditional. It was de rigueur. With anyone else, driving 100 miles for a barbecue pork sandwich and a beer would seem, well, either lunatic or at the very least preposterous. With Russ, it took on the air of pure logic. What I wouldn't give right now to be at Porky's with him. Since that August night when my cell phone rang after midnight with the dreadful news, I've spent many hours rereading Rust's second great gift to the world, his first gift, of course, being his friendship with all of us. I refer, of course, to that classic, and I'm using the word correctly and literally, How to Do Things Right. His voice is there in every word of every sentence on every page. The book is to literature what macaroni and cheese is to food. Pure comfort, pure delight, pure joy. How to need an ice cream cone, how to be kindly. And he was, though he could also be grouchy when the occasion absolutely demanded. How to make and eat milk toast, how to refold a roadmap. How to solve America. How sad that he did not live to see Barack Obama win election to the presidency. How he would have loved that. I'm typing those sentences with exclamation marks because Russ certainly would have. I drove over from Blue Hill to Belfast the morning after Catlin's call. It was a melancholy drive full of thoughts of the buddy I would never again drive to Porky's with. Never again would the phone ring. It's just old Russ calling. No more endless games of anagrams. No more stories of his adventures in the Merchant Marine or the golden era of Esquire. No more nifty insights into the human condition. No more epigrammatic slogans to live by over the kitchen sink, like cleaning up as you go along is half the fun. No more Resto. What an incredibly sad thought. But then after I arrived, Catlin told me how it had happened. In a house on the water in beautiful summery Maine, in the company of his wife and daughter and grandson and son-in-law, Rust had a glass of scotch, a bowl of clam chowder, a slice of blueberry pie, and died, just like that. In the end, the fussy man went out without much of a fuss. Not a bad way to go, really, when you think about it. He did everything right, Rust, to the very end. I'll remember you always, dear buddy. Rest well.
I'm James Salter. People don't die. I was thrilled to be here tonight, really. I loved Rust, but I didn't quite know the breadth of it till tonight. People also don't know how much of a help I was to him. I kept stories that he didn't want to go to the New Yorker from going to the New Yorker. It really wasn't that easy. And I also, among other things, I helped to teach Joy to play poker. That wasn't easy either. I remember the night we were explaining it to her and playing, and in the middle of everything, she, without a word, she simply stood up and walked out the door and left. We didn't see her again. So I don't really know how well she knows the game. But I mean, we did the best we could. I also helped him with his reading. He was, he was extremely well-read, of course, but I suggested to him, I think for the first time, that he read Dead Souls and also Isaac Bible's stories. And I thought he liked them. He appreciated them. And I thought as a result, he would simply come up and embrace me. But he didn't. He had a certain reticence about it. And I felt very clearly that he liked them, but he had writers who were better. And, of course, this great pyramid of excellence, of status, I was under the impression that I thought of it and gave him the idea, but I now see that it preceded me by years, almost by generations. Tom Jenks also worked for him. You may know that there's a wonderful magazine on the internet called Narrative with Jenks and his wife, Carol Edgarian, edit and run. And he wasn't able to be here. They're in California. But he wrote a long thing about Rust in Narrative, and I'm just going to read just a snippet of it for you, because you know Rust very well by now. But Jenks wrote, "Rust was a remarkably gifted, handsome figure, made more so by his apparent imperviousness to ruin. Kitty Carlisle, trying to identify which contestant on To Tell the Truth was the writer, voted for Rust, reasoning that his face looked like an unmade bed. He was witty and sociable, a drinker and smoker who favored camels. The pleasure he took in his habits, the deliberate physicality of striking a match, was immensely seductive. His life seemed enviable. Leisure, modest glamour, and instinctive panache. I had the idea that Esquire started in 1936. I don't know why. I see how I was wrong. But I remember reading it when I was a boy of about 11 or 12, just at the age when you begin to be interested in everything. And I was struck even then by its immense, it's just tremendous, I thought, sophistication. Somebody, I think, Richard Ford or perhaps Byron, mentioned all the writers that were published in Esquire then. These were already famous, famous names, and to see them in a magazine, along with the elegance of how to dress, what to drive, where to go, this was really overwhelming. Well, Russ represented all that to me. I occasionally went to lunch with an editor. He would take me, well, with Lee, precisely, and I had known Terry before, but you know, an editor, that was a very, very big thing. I didn't know any editors. I knew Rust, but he represented something apart from the magazine. He represented, in fact, he embodied the literary world, and he made you believe in a really, in a wonderful way, that this story, this little story you were writing, and that might appear in Esquire, was really an important thing, and that somehow it carried the electricity of the whole world in it. Now, you don't need much more from an editor, really. And even after he retired, even after he retreated to Sarasota, he still said the same things. Send him something. He'd love to read a story of yours. And he usually said, probably, I'm sure to everybody, well, evidently to everybody, ah, just a fabulous story. It really is. He was your reader, in short. He was that one reader you really need, and the reader, in a way, you really write for. Coming into town today, I was reading David Mamet's Speed the Plow. Ah, it's simply brilliant. It's just terrific writing. And I thought to myself, this is something Rust would probably appreciate. And he might say to him, David, you know, what Scott Fitzgerald tried to do in Tender is the Night and failed, you've done in this play. Now, the strange thing is, he said something like that to me once, and I'll never forget it. Thank you.
Thank you, my friends, and thank you all so much for coming tonight. I hope from these testimonials and memories and remembrances and sweet be-do, you have got, those of you who didn't know Rust, some little lightning strike of the kind of extraordinary man he was. So again, thanks for coming. Please adjourn with us outside and remember Rust Hills. Thank you so much.